Welcome back to the Roundtable. Beverly D'Onofrio is known for her popular memoir, Riding in Cars with Boys, where she wrote about her experience as a teen mom. Now she's out with a new memoir about a life-changing incident in her mid-50s. She woke up one night to a rapist in her bed. The book is titled Astonished, A Story of Evil, Blessings, Grace, and Solace. It is a great pleasure to welcome Beverly D'Onofrio to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here.
It's a delight to have you here. I'm a great fan of you and your work. I was noting, I think when the paperback first came out, I received a copy of it, of Astonished, and it says, there's a quote from Sarah Pritchard, and it says, Beverly D'Onofrio is part Abigail Thomas, part Anne Lamott, and part Kathleen Norris. And I thought to myself, I love all of those people.
Me too.
So I love Beverly too. It is that's great company, obviously. So we can get into the overall subject of writing about of how you came to start writing about these details of your life. But what, as a jumping off point, talk about Astonished of how you came to say this happened and now I'm going to share it with my readership.
Well, you know, I'm a memoirist, so it wasn't too long after it happened that I thought, this is material that I'll use one day. I almost immediately began writing about it for O Magazine because I got really militant about wanting to come forward and say, I didn't do anything wrong. The rapist did. I'm not going to hide in shame. Women need not to do that. And I'm going to just kind of jump on a bandwagon and write about the details of this and make that statement at the end that we all need to come out of the closet, since supposedly one in every three women will be raped before they die.
In your experience of what happened here, this happens in Mexico, and just give us the ingredients that led up to what happened.
Well, he was a serial rapist, and there had been four rapes before me in 8 months. I knew the women who had been raped. I was friendly with two of them. I knew the details. I had talked to an ex-FBI agent who was in town helping the police. So when I awoke in the middle of the night to a rapist after having been searching for monasteries to join, although that's another part of the story that I'm sure we'll get to.
Yeah, I actually thought that's where I thought you were originally going to go, but that's okay.
When I awoke to the rapist in my bed, I knew who he was and what was likely to happen. And sure enough, he raped me, and it lasted 2 minutes, and he began to talk about himself or to ask me questions, which was a prelude to talking about himself and how sick he was and how he can't help himself, which would kill time before he raped me again. So I thought, I'm not talking to him. And I began praying Hail Marys, which is what I do anyway, and to absent myself from the situation. And then I thought, wait a minute, I should pray out loud and maybe freak this guy out. So I began praying out loud in Spanish. And as I'm praying out loud, he says, stop praying. You're praying, stop praying, and hits me on my shoulder. And I said, I'm praying for you, which was a lie. And then I thought, wait, I should pray for him. And so I began praying for him. And in the course of praying for him, I realized through this whole ordeal, I hadn't prayed for myself, when I pray for myself all the time, every day when I have to meet somebody I don't know for coffee. So I began praying for myself, Jesus, and interiorly, while verbally I'm saying the Hail Mary and asking God, Jesus, every angel, dead relative, to get this guy out of my house. And he backed out of the bed, patted me on my shoulder and said, it's okay, I'm leaving, and left.
Is there any point where you questioned your faith, where you questioned that prayer was the thing you needed at that moment?
Well, when I had been searching hotly for a monastery to join for 2 weeks.
With your grandson?
No.
No? Okay.
Not with my grandson.
Okay.
It was after my grandson was born.
Your grandson was born and you... Okay, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm talking too much.
No, you tell your story.
Well, my grandson was born, and it kind of threw my life into a relief. Like, I mean, I felt such love for him, and I felt such emptiness in my life by comparison to this new life entering the world. And 8 months later, in a grayness and depression, I go off to a monastery for a short retreat to finish a writing assignment, and I lit on fire and thought, this is the answer. I could dedicate my life to God. I can make the ordinary divine. I could pray with my sisters. I could lift the vibration of the world. This is what I'm going to do. And so for 2 weeks, I'm searching for a monastery to join that will allow me to leave to go visit my grandson, which not many would.
And you knew that that was right for you. How?
What? Which? Going to joining a monastery?
To do this search.
Because I was so lit on fire. I thought that must mean it's a call. I felt in love. I felt like this is what I want. There was just no question. It was the only thing I wanted.
There's a pureness that comes from
that.
So, with all of this, you still have to deal with the trauma of the event.
Mm-hmm. So in the middle of this, the rapist appears, and the first thing I thought was, I might lose God over this. God, how could you send a rapist to my bed in the middle of my search to come closer to you? And my biggest fear was, when I'm done with this evening, I'm not going to believe in God anymore. I'm not going to want God in my life anymore. And that didn't happen.
Why do you think that didn't happen? Because many people have told that story where it has happened.
Yeah. Possibly because I thought to pray, and the praying really paid off. Although, had the prayer not paid off, I still would have entered that kind of God space, and who knows how I would have dealt with it. I don't know, because what happened was the rapist left.
But all of those things have to be going through you through the healing of our violent world, and especially in Mexico, and what was happening to women, and does all of that filter through?
In that moment?
Over time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and it's all part of the book. It's all part of what brought me to write the book that I wrote. The question after the rape was, how can this God that I conceive of and believe to be pure love have created a world with so much evil and violence? And I mean, it's a classic question, and it's not like I didn't ask it before, but suddenly it entered my life, and I needed to find some peace about this. And so I went off to monasteries and I read mystics. Their books would just kind of jump off shelves, the ones that I just needed to read at that moment. And through the process of prayer and being in nature and meditating and silent and writing, I came to some peace with that.
Were you writing about this right away?
Well, you know, as I said, I wrote for O Magazine, but then I really decided that this was an opportunity. This was a liminal space had opened up. This horrible thing had happened to me, and it was an opportunity to grow and to change.
But in the days after, I mean,
after, I already was thinking that.
Yeah.
That this is an opportunity. I mean, I was in shock. So everything was kind of infused with this glow, this other, you know, kind of what you hope happens in prayer. I don't know how to describe it. It's indescribable.
You did not want to be a victim, obviously.
Obviously.
And you also talk in the book about, I mean, you didn't want to lose you. You didn't want to lose a sense of humor. You didn't want to become someone else.
Yeah, but I hoped that I would change also.
Right.
I hoped that this would make me more myself, more who I am in my soul.
A truer self.
That it was an opportunity to let the falseness fall away, to not live behind masks anymore, to be more true.
In reading the book, I kept on, that's the way I read a book, where you ask yourself questions, and the question is, why do we have to have masks? Why do we have to have that? Why do we have to have this falseness? How does that come? And I guess it's part of, I guess, what we were talking about in the last segment as well. It's a part of coping with the current reality, right?
Well, I mean, I saw it with my grandson. By the time he was 3, he had a fake laugh. It's like, it just broke my heart.
Yeah. How did you determine it to be fake?
Well, I know his genuine laugh. And we were in a little social situation, and there were other kids there, and they were laughing, and he joined in to be accepted, to be like everyone else, to, even if he didn't get what they were laughing at, he wished that he did, and so he acted as though he did. And so once you put on an act, then you've got a mask.
You, the subtitle of the book is a story of healing and finding grace. So the healing process, the timeline of that is what? I would guess you're still healing in some way, shape, or form.
Probably. I think it took me 3.5 years to really start the book, because I wanted to experience what I was experiencing without it being about writing a book. And then I said, okay, time to write the book. I started writing the book, and now it happened in 2006. So what are we? It's like 8 years from then. So I have this theory, and it's not my own theory, that the writing of the book was the biggest healing that happened. When I was living at one of the monasteries, a Jungian priest came to work in the gardens. And at that time, there was a vet from Afghanistan who basically was the guy in the Hurt Locker. He had had that job.
Right.
His people had died. He had survived, and he was suffering from severe PTSD. He didn't bathe. He would just talk about the trauma over and over and over again. And he was paired with this Jungian to work for the day. And the Jungian said, I'm going to gift you 2 weeks at my center. I can help you with this therapy called EMDR, which is tapping rapid eye movement. He says, we don't know how it happens, but we move the trauma from the right emotional side to the left logical side, and the triggers no longer have the impact. So I thought, well, that's what I do when I write. I have to relive the experience, feel the emotions, to write it well, to re-enter, to relive it, to put it on the page, but then to make it art, I have to use craft and I have to use the logical side. And I said this to him. I said, I think I've been healing myself through writing from this PTSD. And he said, I absolutely agree with you. And I talk about waking in this book many nights every week, in fear, screaming, thinking that there's an evil presence in my room. Mm. And I haven't had that happen for probably 4 years. It just went away. I healed myself through the writing. I'm convinced of it. But who knows? I mean, there was so much more going on.
And you read about the death of your mother as well.
No, she was sick.
Oh, she was sick.
Yeah, but then she subsequently has died, as has my father after this book.
She's ill, and you're called. I mean, you take a part in that.
Mm-hmm.
So is it? I mean, doesn't that, and that prioritizes things, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't that sort of put everything into some sort of order of okay, this is what I've gone through. This is what my mother's gone through. This is what my family's gone through.
Looking at her mortality?
Yeah.
Sure. And in the end, I left the monastery to be near my parents because I knew it was the end of life and I wanted to spend it helping them and being with them.
And I'm curious, because it seems in the book that greatly helped you as well.
What did? My mother's illness?
Dealing with it. Of coming back, of having that time to be there.
I never thought of it like that, but sure. I mean, just that tenderness and the woman who gave birth to me was on the verge of dying, didn't die, but it made it very clear, it made it very present that she is going to die and what that's going to mean.
Right.
And those moments make you evaluate your own life and life in general and how you want to end your days. And I really want to end my days joyfully and believing that I have forgiven life for being life. I hope that I have and continue to. Life is hard. Life is full of pain. But there's a new day. Spring follows winter, you know.
The title of the book is Astonished. Talk a little bit about that word, that very powerful word of astonished.
Astonished means shaken out of yourself, and that's what the rape did. It shook me out of my complacency, out of the life I was living, out of the way I looked at the world, really. I mean, I talk about drawing close to Christ in this book. It's what I use my monastery time for, partly. And his first words were repent, which means look with different eyes. And basically, I know that I did for the first several years look with different eyes, and I hope I'm still doing it, that it's been integrated. But I don't know, it's really hard to resist the Netflix every night.
So do you, because you were searching, because you were looking for the monastery in the first place, mm-hmm. if not for the rape, mm-hmm. Do you believe that something else would have shaken you out of yourself? Would something else have been astonished?
I hope so. I mean, I think it was one of the best things that has happened to me. And I hope if it wasn't that, it would be something else. And maybe it wouldn't have to be a violent thing. Maybe it would have been a wonderful thing. I don't know. But,
right. But meaning that you were open to the change. You were open. You were searching for that thing that would shake you out of yourself.
Yes. I was searching for it anyway. And it came in this form.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that a monastery would do it. Just the deprivations. Just, you know, being outside of normal society, away from the life I had known, the life I'd lived up until that moment, being cloistered away and obedient to rules I had not set for myself for a change. And who would know? I didn't know what that would be like. And I thought it would transform me. I'm always looking for change. Mm. I thrive on change.
So I was just going to ask you, I mean, are you at a comfortable place now, or are you itching for the next change?
No. Well, I just moved to Woodstock in October, so that was a huge change, and I'm loving it. I mean, I hope that I will stay there, but who knows? My track record isn't very good in that department. And then I got a dog, so that's a huge change. I've never had a dog as an adult.
Did Abigail have something to do with the dog?
Maybe she did.
Yes. I think in reading your work, I mean, I don't know, this is a weird question, but do you feel, because we come to you, and I believe I asked Anil Mott this once, of these... for want of a better term, a crisis that develops in your life that then becomes these stories in a parable, if you will, mm-hmm. that do you feel almost a necessity or an internal need to live something, to be the next story?
You know, I think I used to, and I absolutely do not anymore. And now I wonder if... I mean, I don't really think I had that much to do with it. For example, I was just visiting my father, and he happened to have the heart attack that day while I was visiting. And he was in the kitchen. I was in the living room. I heard it. I went in, and my father's having a heart attack, which ultimately killed him 10 days later. So it's like, why was I the child of the four?
Right.
That's in the kitchen when my father has the heart attack. I mean, it's in the living room when my father has the heart attack in the kitchen.
Okay. So some of this is much more random than...
I think so.
Yeah.
You know, I don't...
We We can't drive that bus all the time, can we?
No, I'm tired of it. I mean, I'm very happy to be like home all the time.
Beverly D'Onofrio's latest, well, but assume still writing.
Yeah. I'm writing a play now, yeah.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Beverly D'Onofrio's latest, now in paperback, is Astonished, a story of evil, blessings, grace, and solace. It is published by Penguin. And Beverly, thank you very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Joe. A pleasure to be here.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.